Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Let's do it.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdal. Welcome back. I hope it's back. I hope you're not a first-time listener, but if you are, welcome. Anyway, Make Me Smart is a podcast. None of us, as we say on Tuesdays around here, is as smart as all of us.
I'm Molly Wood. I hope you are a first-time listener. That means
true.
We're growing.
That's true. That's
Thanks
true.
For
that's
joining
true.
Us. It is Tuesday, whether you are a new listener or a seasoned listener. Tuesday means it's time for our deep dive into a single topic. Today, we are talking about something. This is like the ethos of Make Me Smart right here, which is that someone goes, I wonder, what is the deal with this thing? Can we do a show about that? And then we do, which is the best. The thing that in this case, I think I was wondering about and many others also, which is what's up with economics as a field of study? Is that a thing? Because sometimes there seems to be this disconnect between what economists say will happen and all of those predictions end up, you know, on the front page of a newspaper. And then something totally different happens in the real economy. And then when economists get it wrong, there doesn't seem to be that much accountability. And it seems sort of weird because we're using these findings to set things like game-changing public policy. So we had some questions.
So, you know, there is a place for economists in this economy and in this society. But
yeah.
But maybe how they think about how we think about what they're telling us is what we're trying to get at today. Colin Kammerer is the Robert Kirby Professor of Behavioral Economics at the California Institute of Technology up in Pasadena. Professor Kammerer, thanks for coming on the pod.
My pleasure.
So not to put you in as a proxy for your entire profession, but but how come economic? Let me ask a value neutral question. How come it's so hard for economists to agree and for there to be an actual solution to the problems they study?
Okay, great. Yeah, this is a very profound question. Economics as a profession is not too self-reflective, but it is after times of crisis or embarrassment like the Great Recession. So there are two things that are important, which your listeners may not appreciate. One is there's a big divide in economics between microeconomics, which is a particular market like housing in LA, what if we tax gasoline, and macroeconomics, which is inflation, unemployment, GDP, how do we run the entire economy. And it's a little bit like, say, geology, where we understand a lot about rocks and mountains and how old they are. That's micro. And earthquake forecasting, in which we know there will be a big quake, but I don't know in LA, unfortunately, but we don't know if it's going to be next year, 5 years, 10 years. You know, we know some vague statistical principles. That's kind of like macro. So forecasting and understanding the very complicated aggregate of the system is much harder. And that's kind of understood. Sometimes in public discourse, you may get more confidence attached to forecasts about, say, whether there's going to be inflation in the next couple of years, which people seem quite worried about, than is proper. You know, some of that is different people. Some of it is an economist who may be very circumspect talking to their peers. You know, if they're on a short segment on CNN, they feel like they have to be much more conclusive. Nobody wants to hear, we're not really that sure, call me back next year, right? So that's one thing, macro, micro. The other is that among the social sciences, economics is known for kind of having the most hubris and pride. And some of that is well-deserved because we do understand, for example, unintended consequences. That's something we're really good at understanding. We have more math. But, you know, math is supposed to be used for something, which is to generate insight and kind of discipline your thinking. And it's also true that economists in the U.S. and some European countries, though it varies a lot, have a much bigger role to play in the in advising governments, you know, whether it's regulatory agencies. Like we have a Council of Economic Advisors. In Washington, there's no Council of Sociological Advisors or others. Mm-hmm. Where the forecasting challenges show up are things like the following. The Great Recession in 2008, I think economists as a profession sort of took a pass. It was like nobody understood it. Alan Greenspan didn't see it coming. How could we have seen such a thing coming? But so there was a combination of defensiveness. And the Queen of England famously, you know, sort of pointed her finger at the Bank of England and said, isn't this your job to know when these things may happen? But at the same time, there was a combination of defensiveness, but also a lot of talent in economics quickly pivoted and said, what are the theories we need to understand this, how this happened, and whether it would happen again? Hmm. And so so it's kind of like when there's a big earthquake in California or elsewhere, the earthquake engineers learn a lot about how to prevent new earthquakes and building codes change. And usually that's a pretty healthy process.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you're describing a world in which it might be better for society if we treated economics as a slightly more backward-looking science, as opposed to counting on it. I mean, I will acknowledge here, media problem, right? But counting on economics to forecast as opposed to analyze and then make forward-looking policy as a result might be a little part of where we're going wrong here.
Correct. Yeah, in macro forecasting, for example, the track record is pretty clear. It's very hard to forecast out more than 2 or 3 years. And it's easy to forecast like quarter to quarter GDP. It's just extrapolation. So, you know, if you look at the GDP because of pandemic, it just looks like this bumpy, you know, bumpy like ridge of a mountain. And then there's this plunge and jump back up. And, you know, in looking back, we can kind of say, oh, here's why that happened and here's what's going to happen. But forecasting changes and long-term forecasting is just nobody's very good at that. Similar to long-term weather forecasting, right? Short-term has gotten better and better and better, really good, but long-term not so much. I think the two current examples that are interesting are pandemic vaccine take-up and the Great Resignation. So the vaccine take-up is a really interesting story, and I think it goes back to your question of should we be more humble and what's missing. And so the idea that a vaccine would be created in record time and approved, part of that was helped by an economic idea from Mike Cramer, now at University of Chicago and Nobel Prize winner. And he and others for years have been saying, if vaccine development is held up by incentives, the fact that the vaccine makers don't want to spend billions trying to make this and refitting factories, we should just have advance purchase and said, we're going to buy this stuff whenever you're ready. That was part of Operation Warp Speed, and it made a big difference. That idea came from economics, or at least, you know, from some mixture of people, but Cramer gets a lot of credit for writing it down and pushing it. So the economics had a good role to play early on in getting the medical innovation to occur. But then once you have a vaccine, I think economists for sure and many public health officials thought, well, of course people will take it. I mean, why wouldn't somebody take a vaccine? Sure. It's approved by the FDA. And I think what that story is about is human nature. So, when you have a very mathematical field, you often have a very stylized, simple view of human nature. Like people respond to money incentives and, you know, social norms and the pastor or barber shop in your neighborhood. You know, how could that play a role in getting people to take a vaccine? So economics is often like a bit tone deaf about ideas from their neighboring fields, like sociology, the importance of social networks, or something economics has come to really embrace. You know, a lot of information influence comes from, you know, not reading a newspaper or doing your research, but, you know, what somebody next door tells you or somebody tells you at a barbecue.
How much of that, though, do you think? And I'll point out here that you are a professor of behavioral economics, so your job and your chosen academic field is to try to integrate, you know, the effects of literally human behavior on this supposedly quantitative field, which it is in a lot of cases of economics. But let me ask you this, on the, backing you up to the hubris and and how economists get so much credibility. How much of that do you think is due to the fact that so many economists, the senior ones especially, and the most notable ones, are white dudes?
That plays a role. You know, I mean, it's hard to put something like a number on that, although we could think about a way to do it. But it is true. This is, I think, a kind of dirty secret, and many economists would just not agree with me and even be offended. It is true that the American economics, and European, I think, less so, is kind of dominated by, if you look at the people who run the professional associations or their editors of peer-reviewed journals, which are very prestigious, it tends to be dominated by the Ivy League, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley. You know, almost like a, you know, like a feudal, like, you know, professor, like the editorship kind of the American, you know, just gets passed down like in a small scale society from one person at MIT to their student at MIT to their student at MIT. And along with that has been the fact that economics, compared to other social sciences, has been very slow to have lots of talented women at the rank of full professor and so on. Now there's been a big awakening. There was a big survey a couple of years ago. I think it was when Janet Yellen was the head of the professional association in the U.S., AEA, and the old white people were surprised at how upset LGBTQ and women were about, and minorities, underrepresented minorities, of which there's extremely few, they just don't feel like they're part of the club and the profession and appreciated. Lots of discussions about harassment and some sexual harassment, but also just feeling like no one pays attention to me. When you go to the annual meetings, everyone has a little badge and it says, you know, Colin Kammer, Caltech, Bridget Bodnar, MIT, you know, Connor Kammerer, University of Arkansas. And you could actually, I think you could do a study, no one's done it, in which you look at people's faces and they look down at the tag and it says MIT and it's like, oh, Bridget, you're from MIT. Do you know my friend Tom, Bob,
right.
John?
Right.
Phil, and right. They look down at University of Arkansas, and it's like,
man.
You're invisible.
Invisible.
Yeah.
Now, it, again, to be fair, post Janet Yellen and many others feel like we really have a problem. Like, now, what do we do? So there's a lot more recruiting going to represent minorities, more activities. I still think that at the higher levels of the profession, if you were to, you know, kind of go to meetings, and it's hard to really change the entire thing. You know, unless you have a really sustained effort from the top that goes on for decades and decades. So we're definitely behind on that.
But it does seem like this is part of what makes it so valuable to sort of interrogate the amount of weight that we are putting on these reports and these pronouncements, because, you know, there is a lack of socioeconomic diversity in these points of view, a lack of obviously racial and gender-based diversity, and even cognitive diversity. And so if everybody's just repeating the same thing and we're treating it as science and even religion when it comes to policy, that is something that it is fair, like, to, you know, go back to our central thesis here of the episode, it's fair to ask questions about how right all of this really is, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And a kind of secondary thing, but I think important, is also the scope of things which economists spend their time studying. So there's one of the most fascinating things that's going on in this socioeconomy is the rise of, like, female higher education. So if you look at the percentage of boys in college from 1960 to now in the US, for example, the same is true, I think, in Japan, many countries in Europe. The boys, it kind of goes up at a slow pace. Girls have gone off like a rocket ship. And so lots of competitive schools, you see 55, 57% females, and it's continuing. The gap's going to get bigger. And it's not just money. It's not just straight economics, right? It has to do with girls postponing it, childbearing, maybe boys are playing too many video games. I mean, it's probably a witch's brew of all these complicated things. It has very little to do with pure incentives, the fact that women just, like, discovered that they can earn more money with a college degree. I mean, that's been true for ages, right? So, you know, why is it continuing? And if you thought that was a problem and something we wanted to think about as a society, and we wanted to encourage boys more, and you put together a blue ribbon kind of like an intellectual SWAT team, it's not clear you would want an economist in charge. You would want some economists on the team. And there's some really good ones studying economics of education and social factors. But a lot of the interesting input would come from other fields, you know, who people who are interested in marriage rates, and you'd want to interview a bunch of college kids and do a serious survey, which economists tend to be a little bit allergic to. You know, you do a lot of things that are not at the center of the economics profession today.
So I'm cheating a little bit here, and I'm looking at the Caltech catalog online, and I'm at Economics 19, the freshman seminar, Thinking Like an Economist, instructor Kammerer. So let me ask you this: as you get these 18 and 19 year old kids at Caltech in for Thinking Like an Economist seminar, if you were to get a bunch of lay people in a room, how would you tell regular people, which is not to say that college students aren't regular people, but how would you tell consumers of news, right, to think about economic news that they get, if that makes sense?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the first thing is, who's generating information, why? In fact, we're going to talk about this in my class today. Is there an incentive to kind of exaggerate or puff or outright lie about what you're talking about? And the second thing I would talk about is unintended consequences. So, something that's in the news now is, should there be some kind of a capital gains tax or some kind of a pure wealth tax on the very highest, richest people in our country, like the top 700 billionaires? And part of it is if those billionaires quit doing something they're currently doing, what would that be, and what would be the trickle-down effects? It might benefit some states in America that have low income tax. They would have a boom in places where booms might be needed. So those kind of ripple, second-order ripple effects are something we're pretty good at studying. And when you hear a typical news report, you're really looking at the first part.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about this concept in behavioral economics in particular, this idea of this problem of reproducibility. This sort of gets to the question of economics as art versus science. Tell us what is reproducibility exactly and what we should take away from that.
Okay, so there are essentially two layers of reproducibility. If I get your data and I know what software you used to do an analysis, do I get the exact same answer? And amazingly, the sad fact is that the answer is often, and I'd say often on the order of like a third or a half. It's not 2%. It's often I do not get the same exact answer. Sometimes it's because there was a mistake in the data, what we call data cleaning. You know, like sometimes if there's missing data, instead of a hyphen in a spreadsheet, you put a zero. And zero is really should be a hyphen, but whoever set up the data. So there's a lot of like fussiness about that that's important. And sometimes even the software changes and the way they do matrix inversion changes or something like that. Another problem historically has been even getting people's data to share, what's called open science. So reproducibility economics has been okay, but there's a lot of room for improvement. And the improvement's not too difficult.
Can I back up a little bit? Because I want to make it clear that we're not talking about like personal data. Like you're saying an economist puts out a report that says X thing is going to happen. This many jobs are going to be created because this many trees fell down. And that the peer review system is not that reliable.
It's even more basic than that. So the peer review is kind of like, do I believe this result? Is this going to help us? Is this going to lead to more things people study? Would I want, a policymaker to read this and actually start to think about legislation? The basic reproducibility is sometimes called statistical. It just means if I have exactly your data and I do exactly the thing you said you did, like a recipe, does it taste the same? Do I get the same answer? And so even that, there's been some unfortunate like failures to reproduce. Replicability refers to if I get a new data set or do an experiment with a new group of people, for example, or something that happened in Kenya, I try to reproduce that. You know, you give people small amounts of money in Kenya, see if it improves employment and education. I try to do that in Sierra Leone. Am I going to get the same answer or not? And economics, I think, has been part of the hubris is has not been worried about reproducibility and replicability as much as it should have. I think when some of these early results came out that things didn't reproduce exactly, people were shocked, really shocked. And And we've been moving in a good direction. So most of the economics peer-reviewed journals require you to, post your data. And in fact, some of the journals have a data editor who basically actually goes through, if you have code, they make sure the code runs. You know, it's not enough to just plop it on some website and nobody, and 10 years later, you know, there's cobwebs. So economics has improved in the last 2 years. But the open science movement really came from psychology, which was in really bad shape. And that started about 10 years ago. So even though economics is very innovative about certain things like statistical techniques, we've been kind of laggy about doing open science better.
What should we take away from all of this?
You should be it's hard to do, but I mean, you being journalists, but also listeners, should look for a kind of healthier scientific diet in terms of a balance of sociologists, anthropologists in many cases. I mean, we're the subjects in anthropology too. And in anything that isn't just like jobs, money, savings, that other social sciences have a lot to contribute and often will really fill in the blind spots that seem to be, even with the rise of behavioral economics, which was slow, but then kind of took off, the blind spots are still there.
And good news consumers got to dig out those blind spots. Colin Kammerer, he's the Robert Kirby Professor of Behavioral Economics at the California Institute of Technology. Professor Kammerer, thanks for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
Yeah, so
my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Good stuff.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to be an omnivore, man. That's the deal.
You really do have to be an omnivore. Yeah. It's really true. And I think you just almost have to ignore like headlines. I don't know. You have to read the story.
Read the story.
And ask what... I mean, it seems like with economics, it's like you have to ask what foundational text is this, you know, thesis being based on? And is that foundational text actually still true?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Because, you know, just like political scientists who get, you know, less attention, as he was saying, you know, in the policy making of this country, right, or social scientists or whatever, economists come with different points of view and they use different models, right? And they
that
have different desired policy outcomes. And it's not to say that they skew their research, but that has an effect. And so you gotta read the article. Anyway, tell us what you think.
Well, you have to just not, don't treat it as gospel. Right. I think it's just so, you know. None of it should be, and it's super interesting, and there's different ways to measure. I keep thinking about how we keep talking about GDP all the time, and it's like there's different ways to measure a society's success than growth. That's one simple example of the power of economists.
What'd you learn today? What surprised you? What horrified you, if anything? Let us know. Has it changed the way you think about economics and economic news and how you're going to read it? Let us know. Send us an email, makemesmart@marketplace.org, same old email address.
You can also call us and leave us a voice message. Our now same old phone number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-82-SMART. We'll be right back with the news.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
The the economic news, am I right? I mean, only kind of. It's time for the news fix.
Oh, man. All right. So we were sitting around in our morning news meeting this morning talking about what we were going to say on Marketplace this afternoon. And it's, you know, 6:15 in the morning LA time, and I'm a little groggy, whatever. But we got to talking about some of the news coming out of Glasgow and COP26 and Biden talking about trying to counter the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is sort of the Chinese government's global infrastructure. We're going to almost literally take over the world by building stuff and getting countries to come along and join our sphere of influence at whatever cost, right? Whether it's bad debt or what have you. There's a lot of shady things going on in the Belt and Road Initiative. But one of the things we got to talking about was how the U.S. is already like 9 or 10 years behind the Chinese in this sort of global infrastructure attempt that Beijing is doing. And then Sabri Benishore, who I'm sure many of you have heard, said there was an article in the Financial Times today about the AI fight and how the Chinese are kicking our butts. And if you look at Huawei and sort of the 5G infrastructure and all of this, they're ahead sort of technologically. They've got, and Molly, you'll know this better than I do, right? They have the edge in battery technology too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. At least right now, and certainly right. In production, it's right. Sort of this double whammy, which I think is so interesting, is that China has the edge increasingly in software and machine learning and hacking, right? Yes. Like cyber capabilities, as it's often referred to, and then also can just go ahead and make the hardware that they need to do all of these things.
Which gets me to this article in Financial Times, which was and is mildly horrifying. I will read you the first and last paragraph. The Pentagon's first chief software officer said he resigned in protest earlier this month at the slow pace of technological transformation in the United States military and because he could not stand to watch China overtake America. And let me jump to the last paragraph where he says, so he's a serial technology entrepreneur, this guy, whose name is Chilin. His name is Nicholas Chilin, if I'm pronouncing that right. And here's what he said to close the article. Here's the kicker. The serial technological entrepreneur who started his first business at 15 in France said he also began to feel stale because he spent his 3-year stint at the Pentagon fixing basic cloud things and laptops.
Oh, God.
Chief technology officer at the Pentagon.
Oh.
So there you go.
He resigned a week ago?
Earlier this month. 10th of October is the article in the
earlier in the month. Yeah, but still, wow.
Yeah, that's 3 weeks ago.
That's
cray cray, right?
That's yeah,
that
you're just doing basic like IT.
Updating cloud stuff. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. We're all set. that was it. That's my news.
I mean, yep.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
That's a cue the dark place sting kind of moment because, woo!
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. There it is.
There it is.
Liana Scarlacci never wanted to miss her cue.
Boom.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah.
You're going to want to keep that one ready because, man, this Zillow story
crazy
is so fascinating. Let me take you back to just a few weeks ago when there was like a viral video about Zillow buying and selling houses and is Zillow buying them for, you know, more than they're worth. And It was a viral video that made everybody wonder if Zillow was artificially manipulating the market. And then increasingly, as the weeks have gone on, these stories are coming out almost in tandem. It seems that, if anything, Zillow was just overpaying for houses because it's not that good at buying houses, potentially. And now comes a story in Bloomberg that was published yesterday about how Zillow bought all these houses and is now looking to sell 7,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
For $2.8 billion because it's been trying to, you know, buy these houses and flip them and then resell them because it's been such a hot market. Bought too many, so many that it couldn't get like people to come in and fix them up. And then in many cases, it sounds like these houses were ending up listing for less than Zillow paid for them. So now here's Zillow in the position of trying to unload all of these houses to potentially a multitude of buyers, most likely to landlord investors. And that's a really interesting business story. And then you think about the economics of housing and the unavailability of housing in this country. And you think about the fact that a single company is sitting on 7,000 to 8,000 homes that is just going to try to unload onto the market as though they were hog futures to landlords when owning a home is still considered the best way to build wealth in this economy. And you just have questions about the free market and if any part of it is a free market at all. Like, what? Yeah. In the, like I mean, this. It is just, this is like shocking and depressing on so many levels. Like, this company is literally taking thousands of homes out of a market that has no supply and is not intending to sell them to people. It's just like offering them up like a commodity. Maybe it's the most efficient market and I'm totally wrong. Maybe it's the freest of markets and everybody's screwed as a result. But wowie wow, is it a hell of a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hell of a story. I have a little baby make me smile, even though we don't do that. I just wanted to say that, you know, like, I'm not sure that a ton of awesome news is going to come out of COP26 based on, for example, the very tepid statements that you covered so well coming out of the G20. But there is some good news. A deal will officially be announced today that there has been a major commitment from 100 world leaders representing more than 85% of the world's forests to agree to end deforestation by 2030. And this includes Canada, Russia, Colombia, Indonesia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and crucially, Brazil.
Now here's the question, like, do you believe it?
I mean, I just have to sort of announce it as good news. Like, there will always be holes in enforcement.
Yeah.
Like, we're really to the point where we got to hope for the best. We got to hope people mean it and that there is some oversight and accountability for it, because these are, you know, we've talked a little bit about how trees work to to sequester carbon from the atmosphere to help clean it up. They are nature's decarbonizing technology, and deforestation, it actually creates like an add-on effect, you know, like these areas are deforested and then the trees can't capture the carbon. And then also they're developed or the trees are burned, which adds more carbon into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to cheer this far and wide and hope that people stick to it, because it's a huge deal.
Yeah. All right. Shall we?
Yep. Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
All right. So, in fact, closer related to what Molly was just talking about, I despaired a little bit yesterday on the pod with Marielle about the COP26 conference and whether it was going to actually do anything. I asked you all to send your thoughts. Some of you did, which is awesome. Here you go.
Hello, this is Ray from Lesby, Maryland. Y'all were pretty hollowed out on Monday about the COP summit, but at least the U.S. is there and actively participating to at least try to come up with plans to save the planet. Also, I noticed at the G20 summit that the other world leaders were not openly mocking the president as they had in recent meetings. So I think we are making some progress here. Thanks for making me smart and making me use brain cells that would not normally have to exercise. See ya.
Aw.
Yeah. Fair comments both, Ray. Fair comments both. I don't know. I was grumpy yesterday.
President Biden apologized too, which was interesting.
I know,
for having the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Agreement.
Which was big. Yeah. Here's another couple. Jean wrote in to say that she agreed with me on the COP26 summit, and she said, quote, "We're doomed. How can you get males to give up their powerful, huge pickups?" Also a fair comment. Sam in Texas said, the methane reduction is a big win, and I see COP26. That's news from today, the plan to reduce methane, or as the Brits say, methane, in the atmosphere. It's a big win. It's a big win, Sam says, and I see COP26 as firing the starting gun on the march forward for worldwide climate action. So, yes, Sam, I totally agree that the methane thing is big. I would also just point out that if this is the starting gun, this is the 26th conference. Where have we been for the past 26 years? Sorry.
I mean, look, the best time to start was 20 years ago. Yeah. The second best time to start is today.
Yep. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
The methane thing is big. Also, methane? I'm totally going to start saying that nonstop.
I heard the BBC this morning. Methane.
Oh, that's amazing. I love it. Chris, it's delightful. It's better than aluminum.
Aluminium, yes.
Aluminium, which I also love. All right. Chris in Santa Clara, California wrote in about Marketplace expediting banana pants. Can that be like a band name somehow? Expediting banana pants. He writes, I'm a Marketplace supporter and just wanted to say thanks for the expedited banana pants, but I could have waited by choosing air freight. The carbon footprint of my banana pants from 0.029 tons of carbon went to 8.37. tons of carbon. Numbers are per ton of cargo shipped from Shanghai to LA via ship versus plane.
Ouch.
Ouch. Ouch. Fair. Yeah. Turns out the producers write in and say, your math checks out. People wrote in asking about the carbon footprints of the Banana Pants plane, which is actually great. That means that, like, the things that we're saying are getting through, even if we're not always doing a great job at them. But these are the interesting trade-offs. This is a perfect microcosm of human trade-offs when it comes to climate.
Right.
And so far, American consumers have not wanted to wait for anything ever.
I was just going to say, we should get Stephanie Patterson on the pod and say, hey, listen, if you had to pay for the excess carbon, right, which is, you know, 8.37 tons to 0.029 tons, if you, out of your pocket, marketplace development person, and had to pay for that carbon, would you have done it? And I suspect the answer will be no.
You know? I know.
Yeah.
It really would be. But that is such an outstanding point, and that is exactly the question. And if anything were priced at what it really cost,
right,
then exactly, no one would do it.
Don't get me started on water. Out,
you guys are so smart.
Yeah.
You're so smart.
Great observation. All right. We leave you as we do every week with the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
I used to believe that the tongue had specific regions on it which were designed for specific tastes. You know, the tip of the tongue was meant for tasting sweet things. The sides or the back were for sour or bitter and so on. As it turns out, that's totally wrong. There are no divisions of the tongue which are designed and built for tasting certain kinds of flavors. So that's something I thought I knew that I was wrong about.
Wait, what?
We've
seen diagrams of the tongue. I've seen it like in encyclopedias and stuff.
I mean, what? This answer is from a linguist that Kimberly Adams spoke to on Marketplace Tech about Facebook's name change. Interestingly, his name is Anthony Shore, and he is a person who is qualified to talk about everything from Facebook's name change to the giant lie that is the tongue chart.
That's cray cray.
God, is anything true? I don't know.
That's the theme of the podcast today, because we started with economists and now we're ending with linguists and your tongue.
It really is. Oh, is anything man. New?
Nothing,
is anything
nothing
true?
Is true? Nothing's true.
All right. Don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. Please consider calling us and leaving a voice message at our number 508-82-SMART, which officially as of today, I'm no longer calling our new number.
I'm with you there. Yep.
Yep. It's our number. That's it.
That's it. The whole smash.
Peas out, peeps. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Today's program was engineered by Liana Squilacci with mixing by Jake Cherry. Our intern is Grace Rubin.
Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez, who have the best contract in the history of music, getting the names in this podcast every freaking day, did our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bonner. Donna Tam is the interim director of On Demand Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. Of course, I'm pretty sure they don't get
paid. I think also just graduated from the new guy.
Oh, yeah. He's no longer the new guy. Yeah.
Yep. Nope. That's it.
Definitely not.
Honeymoon is over.
Sucks for you, pal.
You're the guy. He's the guy.
Oh, man.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.